Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Welcome everyone to another episode of the Damage Report. I am John Adirola. It is a big one. And so we've got a big guest actually. Michael Shore in studio. Always glad to have you here.
A huge guest.
Huge guest. He's right. Massive.
What a disappointment. There was a second word.
It's like the
we've
Lord
got a big guest today, and
it's
so Michael Shore's in the studio.
Yeah. Great. We've got Michael Shore. We are both abiding by the new dress code, I guess.
Yeah, I'm actually a bit more, I guess.
No, it's fall appropriate.
Yeah. That's
especially
right.
Because it is raining incredibly hard in LA today.
And we're the only news channel in Los Angeles that is not leading with the rain.
Is that really?
Yeah, it's got to be. When it rains in Los Angeles, unbelievable. Mm-hmm.
I mean, so technically we just talked about the rain. What more could you, it's raining.
Right.
That's it.
Oh, here, it's the runoff from the campfire. It's the runoff from the-
No, I think it's the runoff from the clouds,
Woolsey
actually.
Fire, right. Yeah,
I think it came from up there.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we've got a lot for you today. We have got a potential bombshell from Donald Trump's former lawyer, huge news there. We've got two Fox News hosts who are teetering on the brink of actually understanding how our economy has been manipulated to benefit the wealthy against the rest of us. And then we've got a really interesting study, I hope that we have time to get to it, about how Donald Trump both appeals to and benefits from male physical and sexual insecurity. That is gonna be a fun one. Along the way, we're also gonna be joined by two guests Skyping in. One, Eric Olson of the National Resources Defense Council is gonna be Skyping to talk about the E. coli outbreak and how a Trump administration deregulation policies directly contributed to this sort of outbreak. One of many that we've had actually just this year. And then later on, we're gonna have a fascinating interview with a political scientist who studied how effective racist political advertising actually was in these last midterms. There were some horrendous ads, but were they actually helpful to the Republicans? We'll break that down a little bit later on. Before that though, we've got Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen has apparently reached a new plea deal with the special counsel's office while at the same time pleading guilty to new crimes. Apparently he was a bit of a liar when he was talking with Congress about some of the things that he knew and did during his time with Donald Trump. He had told Congress that the Trump Tower Moscow project ended early in the campaign, this effort to get a Trump Tower built in Russia, that he hadn't discussed it much with others at the Trump organization, and that he hadn't talked to the Russian government about it. As part of the deal, Cohen admits all of those claims were false. The discussions continued into June 2016. He briefed Trump and Trump's family members on the project more often than he'd admitted, and he talked with a Russian government official about the project. So we've heard multiple times from Michael Cohen that this wasn't going on. We also have heard constantly from Donald Trump that there was no business, no dealings, no ties whatsoever. That, of course, is now proven to be false.
Yeah, and if you believe Michael Cohen, that the Mueller people have moved on from what they've gotten out of Paul Manafort, now that that plea deal is off the table, mm-hmm. and they're going to sentence him, and they go to their next. Not that they wouldn't have done them both at the same time and simultaneously, but they now, and it's interesting too, every time the president gets on a plane, there's a big drop. When he went to Helsinki, there was, he left for Argentina today. But this is important, and this is, listen, there was no public trust placed in Michael Cohen by anyone. The fact that he lied under oath is illegal and something he's going to have to plea out of. But that we now know the truth about this and that there is a different version than the one that he gave and the president has given, and also most importantly, or not most importantly, but very importantly, Donald Trump Jr. as well.
And let's note before we move on that previously Michael Cohen had received a number of charges. He's already pled guilty to them. And you might think that the things that he and Donald Trump did in advance of the election warrant impeachment or whatever, but it was contained inside of the US. This is the first time that his activities are directly related to the question of potential collusion with a foreign power. So we do actually have that. If you believe Michael Cohen, it looks like those conversations were going on. And some of the conversations actually are even worse. So he had previously talked with Felix Sater. This is one of his business associates. Sater had emailed Cohen, this is I believe in 2015, "I will get Putin on this program and we will get Donald elected." This is during their talks about having that tower in Moscow built. "Buddy, our boy can become president of the USA and we can engineer it. I will get all of Putin's team to buy in on this." Trump's company signed a letter of intent to build the tower in late 2015, around the time of that email. And when Cohen saw a news story about Putin praising Trump, he emailed Felix Sater, "Now is the time, call me." So look, Felix Sater is a developer, is a businessman. He is Russian born, but so far as I know, he doesn't have any tight ties to the Russian government or anything like that. So he can say whatever he wants. That's not proof by itself, but it does show that there was this belief that there could be some sort of coordination as far back as 2015.
Yeah, and it also shows, one important part of solving every crime, if you watch enough of those shows, is motive. Mm-hmm. And here you have motive shown by the businessman Donald Trump and his associates going forward. So, one of the things that Trump said today that I thought was most telling about where his head was on this, he said there was a good chance that I wouldn't have won, in which case I would have gotten back into the business. And why should I lose lots of opportunities, right? Mm-hmm. This was all motivated by that, and it continued. Yeah. So the fact that there's a developer, Felix Sater, that Michael Cohen is playing this kind of both interference and facilitating role, I think it speaks volumes about where Trump's mind was at that point.
Yeah, and it seems reasonable to say that no rational billionaire would risk spending the rest of their life in jail for colluding with a foreign power to get an additional hotel bill. That seems crazy.
Right. I mean, as a rational billionaire, I'm going to have to recuse myself from this conversation. But yeah, you're right.
But Donald Trump is not a rational person.
Right.
He is a crazy person, also possibly not a billionaire. But he's not a rational person. So if somebody was going to do this, he might well have been the person, especially if you consider that particularly early on in 2015, from all of the accounts that we've gotten from inside of Donald Trump and his inner circle, he didn't think he was going to win anyway.
Right. Well, and that's what makes this sort of fascinating. Like, there's this, oh my God, I might win moment that had to have happened to Donald Trump. And I think it happened on election night, but other people think it happened sooner. And then when that happens, there's this panic over what are people going to find out about my business dealings? Mm-hmm. And are my business dealings going to suffer because of this? And how do I cement them, literally, but also figuratively, cement them to the point where they are untouchable if this should happen?
Yeah.
And so I think that this all speaks to that narrative about not expecting to have won. He said it, in essence, today.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if we had gone through that election and he had lost— It turns out that winning was sort of the worst thing legally for him, because then you investigate potential reasons that he might have won. If he had lost, does anyone believe that Hillary Clinton would be doing a multi-year investigation of Donald Trump?
No.
No, Donald Trump still tweets constantly about Hillary Clinton. He still thinks that we're enmeshed in the 2016 election. But the Democrats are always looking forward. They're not looking back.
So it turns out he's the one who's most tired of winning.
Potentially, he's tired of it. And he's also tired of Michael Cohen. His initial comments on what happened today, he said, Michael Cohen is a weak person, claims he's lying to get a reduced sentence. And so this continues his trend of anyone who cooperates with the government and law enforcement is a rat and a weak person, where Donald Trump speaks less like the president and more like one of the side characters on an episode of The Sopranos.
Right.
Again, remember, this is his government, his law enforcement agency. You rat, you're working with them. So a little bit of conflict of interest there. And he also said, now that it's out there that they had been trying to get this tower built, he says, it would be nothing wrong. I was running my business while I was campaigning. It would be nothing wrong. Okay, well, that's interesting. If it would be nothing wrong, why did you spend literally year after year after year, I think it was three of them, lying about these deals that you had? And if you were a Trump supporter and you bought those denials, isn't it odd that he was hiding the fact that he potentially was going to financially benefit from this deal while telling you he wasn't and potentially getting help and even appealing for help from Russia. Isn't that the slightest bit weird?
Yeah, not as weird as Angela Merkel showing up in all of this conversation so much.
In the B-roll?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a little bit weird. So really fast, another thing on Donald Trump, because his obstruction of justice and weird approach to law enforcement continues. In an interview with the New York Post, Trump was asked about a photoshopped image that he retweeted that depicted targets of Trump's attacks like Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Robert Mueller, Huma Abedin for some reason, James Comey, and it had the text, "Now that Russian collusion is a proven lie, when do the trials for treason begin?" And also, so that's all basically people that he hates, people who are outside of government. But Rod Rosenstein was on there and he was asked about that. And he said that Rosenstein belongs in jail for treason because he should have never picked a special counsel. Those are the words of a man innocent of any wrongdoing.
Right. Right. And I mean, listen, it's part of his job. Once the attorney general recuses himself, Rosenstein's job, pick a special counsel when there's a need for it. It's just not wanting things to go the way that the rules say they go.
Exactly. Yeah. And the president of the United States is retweeting a meme saying that all of his political opponents are guilty of treason and should go to jail.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Right.
Including just like Huma Abedin.
Why not? Everybody.
God knows. Okay, with that, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, very important information to get to, the E. coli outbreak. How bad is it? Are we actually starting to deal with it now? We'll find out after this. You might have noticed recently that it's difficult to find romaine lettuce for a really good reason. There is a gigantic outbreak of E. coli, meaning it had to be stripped from stores throughout the country. Was it some act of God, or did the government have a role to play in this? We're joined now by a guest who knows quite a bit about this, Eric Olson, Senior Director of Health and Food at the National Resources Defense Council. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you here. So first, an overview, this outbreak, the romaine lettuce situation, how bad is it actually?
Well, it's pretty bad. We do know that a lot of people have already gotten sick, dozens and dozens. We also know that it's widespread. It's across the country. And I think as the information is coming in, we're going to learn that there are a lot more people that have gotten sick that we don't know about yet.
So I've read your blog about this. I know you also did an interview with Salon about some of the things that might have caused this to happen. In terms of government regulation, the influence of the government over industries that produce this this romaine lettuce, what do you think might have contributed to this particular outbreak?
Well, we don't know for sure what caused this, but you may remember that only a few months ago, we had another huge E. coli romaine lettuce outbreak. That previous one looks like it was probably connected to manure basically getting into the irrigation water that was used to irrigate the lettuce. And there's a good chance that a similar thing is happening here, that basically what sometimes happens is these huge factory farms are located not very far away from the romaine lettuce that's being grown, and poop basically gets into the water. and it's used to irrigate the lettuce, or sometimes it's even sprayed onto the leafy greens as part of a pesticide mixture. And it's a fundamental problem that we were supposed to deal with some federal regulations. Actually, the Food and Drug Administration issued these rules. They were supposed to take effect in January of this year, but the Trump administration suspended them and said we're not going to enforce them for the, you know, for many years probably.
So I'm glad that you brought that up, because you mentioned that in your blog as well, sort of the change in approach to regulation of these sorts of issues between the Obama administration and the Trump administration. The regulations that you're talking about there, the ones that were intended to go into effect already, what were they aiming to do?
Well, it's called the Produce Safety Rules, and they have been a long time in coming. But basically, what, among other things, what they would have done is made sure that the water that is used to irrigate our leafy greens and other vegetables that we eat raw is supposed to be checked to make sure it isn't contaminated with manure and E. coli and things like that before you put it into contact with the food that we're going to be eating raw. It's just common sense. But the Trump administration came in and said they were suspending those rules and they're going to take another look at them, probably roll them back. They're saying they may not even implement them until 2024 fully. And honestly, I'm not sure we can trust that even that's going to happen.
Eric, a question to you, sort of a question with a follow-up, since we're not in the White House press room, I can do that. I want to ask you a little bit about the water in California and the people that have been fighting for water in California that has undergone essentially a 7 to 8 year drought right now, and how much of that is a factor in what we're seeing come out of these farms in California. And then an unrelated question about what the ripple effects of this are. People who say, oh, well, I won't eat salad for a week, but these have far-ranging effects, don't they?
They do have far-ranging effects. So we're not sure exactly what the cause of this specific outbreak is, but we do know in case after case, you may remember years ago, there was a huge outbreak of spinach contamination. We've had a couple of these romaine lettuce outbreaks. We've got a lot of other fruits and vegetables that have been linked to outbreaks like this. And it's very often the water that's used to irrigate the vegetables or the leafy greens. Sometimes it's the water used to wash them. But fundamentally, we've got a huge problem, which is why we had these rules that were supposed to be the road, clear road map for how we're going to avoid these disease outbreaks. And unfortunately, we're seeing rollbacks of that from the Trump administration. As to the relationship between an outbreak like this and the drought, I'm not clear exactly what the linkage might be. We do know that there's a shortage of water in some areas. Sometimes you can see more contamination when the water levels drop. You can see more of the manure and so on getting into irrigation water sometimes. So whether there's a link or not, we're not sure yet. I think we'll find that out.
In your recent blog, you say that it's time now that even lettuce is unhealthy. It's time for us to fundamentally rethink how we approach food safety. If we were to do that, what would you like to see the government do going forward?
Well, it makes no sense. I mean, really, is our salad more dangerous than the pie we're eating? I mean, that we should not be at this standpoint now. It makes no sense. So we would like to see these rules put back into place immediately. The suspension of them makes no sense. We know it had hundreds of millions of dollars in benefits, in public health benefits, to have the rules in place. But because a few folks in the industry didn't want to implement them because they would cost a little bit more, the Trump administration rolled them back. So let's put those rules back into effect. Let's start enforcing the rules. Let's make sure that we have the staff at the FDA to go out and make sure that the rules are complied with. I mean, it's basic. You want a cop on the beat. You want somebody making sure our food is safe. Consumers shouldn't have to worry when they go into the grocery store and buy a head of lettuce or buy vegetables whether or not they're going to get E. coli poisoning.
It's funny, conservatives love a cop on the beat when it's a cop on the beat, but when it's a government oversight, they recoil. You talked about the cost of what it would mean to the government to enforce this. What about the cost to these outbreaks? It's not just simply a farmer who loses a crop or of romaine, is it? What are those effects?
Yeah, well, the costs to the public are enormous. I mean, we see large numbers of people being hospitalized. The last outbreak of romaine killed at least 5 people. I mean, so these health impacts are enormous and something we really need to worry about. And when you put a dollar figure on that, just from things like cost of hospital treatment and related health impacts that you can put a dollar number on, the costs of these outbreaks are just so much larger than the costs that are much smaller to industry to implement these protections. It makes zero sense for us to be rolling back these protections.
And that seems to be the case in most of these cases where deregulation leads to these bad effects, whether it's in food or in energy or things like that. Eric Olson, I want to thank you for joining us, Senior Director of Health and Food at the National Resources Defense Council. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, lots more news for you after this. Welcome back to the Damage Report, everybody. Michael Shore is in the studio today. Lots more to get to. Before we do, though, I do want to say we are now live streaming to our members. In addition to YouTube TV, the members get it live as well. So hello, members. If you are watching this as a member, send me a tweet. I would love to know how many people are actually up at this point in the day watching it live. And also, if you are not on YouTube TV, if you're not watching it live, if you are listening to the podcast of this, it would be a great time, by the way, to leave a review and a rating for the podcast. It is super fast. It is fun. I will read your rating, especially if you screenshot it and tweet it to me, and I will send you back a funny GIF in response. But those ratings are incredibly important for the discoverability of the podcast. So if you want progressive news like the Damage Report to get to a bigger audience, that is one very easy, quick way that you can contribute to that. I would personally love to get to 1,000 ratings. We're very close. We're at like 940 right now. So please take a couple of seconds out to do that. Whether you're listening to this on a podcast or not, just go to iTunes, rate it. Just one click. With that, why don't we jump back to the news?
Let's do it.
Okay. If you're in the news business, let's say Fox News, you talk a lot about politics and you have a stance. Obviously, Fox News comes with politics from a particular point of view. But if you just talk enough, occasionally, like by covering the news, following it, you can sort of get close to a realization that takes you out of your news bubble. And today I want to spotlight 3 people on Fox News that got so close to understanding what's really going on. That is absurd. Okay, so we've got, like I said, 3 people for you. I want to start with Brian Kilmeade, who has noticed, as many of us have around the country, that that tax bill, the promises that were made about it, doesn't really seem to be generating the benefits that we were promised.
They got a huge corporate tax cut, didn't they? And wasn't the thought was that the American industry would start bringing industry home because our corporate tax rate was now competitive?
Absolutely. There's no reason why we shouldn't be selling cars in China that are made here. Now, the president has to open up the Chinese market, and, you know, I guess that's the next stage. But abandoning the American worker, she says that Americans aren't buying sedans. Do you see Toyota getting out of the sedan business? They make money on sedans. They know how to make sedans well.
So Brian Kilmeade there realizes, so they drastically cut our corporate tax rate, being promised this is going to generate huge, explosive economic growth, but it's not. Instead, GM cut 15,000 jobs just in one motion. So Brian Kilmeade got so close there, but do you believe that, like, going forward, he will question the next round of tax cuts?
There's no way. And he brings up Peter Morici is sort of a really reasonable, smart guy on the economy and this sort of thing, and he brings that kind of a guest on. It's always going to be a dangerous place for a Fox News anchor because they're going to tell you what's happening and then they have to dance around it. But yeah. No way.
Yeah, and in what Peter Morici was saying, it was like one on the sedans, yeah, probably they don't make as good of sedans. That's part of the issue. The second he's like, and the next phase is we're going to sell our cars in China. That's what we need to do. As Donald Trump is out there saying that he's potentially going to slap massive additional tariffs on cars coming from there, which we know will lead to them doing the same thing, which will make it harder for us to sell cars there. So Brian Kilmeade, the tax cuts don't actually lead to explosive economic growth. They lead to big corporate stock buybacks, as we talked about with Congressman Ro Khanna yesterday on the show. Next up, Charles Payne, so close on the fundamental issues with modern American capitalism.
It's not like they're in dire straits. Now, they're trying to get ahead of things. They want a big fat cash flow. But this is why I think capitalism in of itself is in a lot of trouble in this country. Because, you know, these companies keep posting record earnings and they keep firing people. They keep posting record earnings and they keep buying back billions of dollars of their own stock. The American public is going to get hip to this. And my fear is that they're going to end up electing not a democratic socialist, just a straight up socialist because of these kind of shenanigans. They should have saw this coming a long time ago.
So that's funny, because that's not only the most reasonable thing I've ever heard Charles Payne said. I think that's the only reasonable thing I've ever heard Charles Payne
say. It's also something that reasonable people have been saying for years. And it just sort of, he's treating it as if it's breaking news, right? I mean, listen, hey, look what's happening here. No, people have been, this has been a drumbeat for a long time, for decades.
It's finally reached Fox News. And it's finally reached Fox Business.
It's gotten inside the bubble there,
So there, like, he is totally right. They're making record profits, but it's not translating into jobs. In the same way that we keep pointing out that American worker productivity is massively going up, but not we're not having the same sort of increases in wages.
Right.
Like, those gaps between what should be influencing a beneficial, increasing good situation for American workers and what's happening with the corporations themselves, that is not some accident. It's not some weird mystery. We don't need Sherlock Holmes. We know why we have that. It is due to government action and inaction on some areas. And Charles Payne seems to understand that on some level, but I have a feeling that going forward with his show, it will not be echoed.
But also, he's talking about a socialist, as if this is after the election where they lost 40 House seats, right? Yeah. I mean, that's the chickens coming home to roost on this tax bill.
Yeah.
And especially in California, where it's like, okay, you've got some rich white people who are going to be hurt by this, and then they flip the whole House.
Yeah.
It's really, it's almost shocking to see their naivete on display that way, when it really happens.
And I don't understand the political approach. He says they're making record profits, but they're cutting jobs. So my fear is that people will go in a different direction. Why is that your fear then?
Right.
Like, okay,
that's a great
Charles
point
Payne,
too, because why isn't that should be something you embrace if you're upset about this.
Or present some other direction we could go in. But he's not doing that. Charles Payne is there for Fox Business. Fox Business is, of course, going to come at things from the point of view of business. Well, business is doing fine. You don't need to worry about them, as you said, record profits. So at some point, can't you also be concerned about the workers? Like, everything he said there was from the point of view of that this could lead to an outcome that's bad for business, rather than it is already bad for the actual people that we should be caring about. Whether you're a conservative or a liberal, this is obviously a bad state of affairs, not for the consequences it might have for the stock price or the board of directors going forward, but for where we are right now as a country. And he's so close to getting that. Now we have one more. This is going to go back a little bit, but it's again the same sort of thing. The promises that have been made economically, the results that we're having right now, Stuart Varney, he's so close on the deficit.
With the economy doing so well, we're growing what, 4%? 4%. Why is the deficit going up? It's not supposed to be like that, is it?
Well,
strong growth, higher deficit.
Give me a year.
You know it's not supposed to be like that.
And you know it's not supposed to be like that, Stuart Varney. And Stuart Varney is a terrible guy, but he seems to get it there. They're doing great. The corporate tax cut is, as expected, leading to higher earnings. They're getting more money and everything like that. And yet the deficit is exploding. So why is that?
Well, give me a minute.
Okay. It is complicated.
It's terribly complicated. It's funny, too, because Varney and Kudlow were essentially colleagues or peers for such a long time. Mm-hmm. And to hear Varney go after Kudlow in that way about something that they've been fighting against together and separately for such a long time is remarkable. But this is, you know, the segment that you're doing here of coming so close is so interesting when you see these three clips and when you forecasted to me yesterday. I wonder if there's something going, I mean, I know this isn't happening, but something going on at Fox where they're starting to turn a little bit because they realize they have to, not because they want to.
Maybe.
And because this is sort of the new generation of Fox leadership kind of sneaking in a little bit. But I don't believe that, honestly, because I don't think they're down Stuart Varney's ear saying, ask this question this way. But it makes a lot of sense also politically, because maybe they're going to try and seem more reasonable to people that they lost in November. I don't know. I mean, I'm not somebody who buys into this sort of conspiracy that they all get into a room and say, we're going to do it this way, other than the sort of overarching conservatism and support for the administration. Yeah.
They sure do all coalesce around what story to talk about each day, really.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So for Stuart Varney and for people who maybe you just watch reasonable news and you don't watch a lot of Fox News, I want to explain why he is so bamboozled. Because the way it's supposed to go, the way that it's been sold to us, is you radically cut corporate tax rates, which obviously means that all else being equal, the government gets less money. But they get so much more money, the corporations, that they invest and they create better products, and it leads to economic growth, which means that somehow you can cut corporate tax rates, but more economic activity is generated, and that means that the revenue to the government is the same or higher. That's the promise that's given to us. That's what Stuart Varney and all the rest on Fox believes would happen. Now they're shocked. We got half of that. The corporations are making more money, but the government isn't making more money. Why is that? Because that extra economic output does not actually happen. And I would say, was that actually the goal to begin with? It's not about generating more overall activity, it's about generating higher profits. Now, what I always love is when politicians push for something that has an immediate, obvious effect, and then a hypothesized secondary effect. And people are sold on this hypothesized secondary effect. That's what trickle-down economics is. While they are raking it in on the immediate obvious consequence of this change, which is higher corporate profits. We didn't get the secondary effect. We didn't get it the last couple of times they cut taxes either. We're not gonna the next time they do it. So Stuart Varney, or people who haven't clued into this yet, conservatives maybe who are, you know, honest and just don't get how this works, it's never actually gonna happen, okay? You don't need to go through this uncomfortable process that Stuart Varney is resisting inside of his mind to understand that the economic philosophy that he is espousing doesn't actually work out in practice. We have seen it over and over again, even up to and including this year. We're living in it right now. This is simply the way it goes.
And also, when they do these tax cuts with the promise, the secondary promise of increased wages and increased hiring, that doesn't happen either. And this tax cut has proven, I mean, it keeps proving it when you see GM, what they're doing, and you hear the way that Payne and Varney are talking about it. It's indicative of the fact that it hasn't happened.
Yeah. And as a second dose to that, the beliefs about, you know, the protectionism and the new tariffs and all of that, how that would benefit us, that's also not benefiting us as well. That's partially to blame for this GM situation as well. That said, we are going to take a short break. When we come back, another guest. Racist political advertising. We saw a ton of it in these midterms. Does it actually help the Republican candidates? We'll figure it out after this. Throughout these recent midterms, we had some of the most blatantly racist political advertising, I think, that I've ever seen. I think that that's fairly safe at this point. California was the site of one of the big ones. And the question is, does that actually benefit the candidates who are running these clearly racist ads? And thankfully, we're going to be joined on the show right now by someone who has done some research directly on this. Manish Arora, a PhD candidate at UC Irvine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming. You have an analysis of your recent research appeared in the Washington Post. Is it possible to combat appeals to prejudice? And you did particular research on the Duncan Hunter ad. I want to play just a brief excerpt of that ad in case people were lucky enough to have not seen it.
Amar Kapanajar is working to infiltrate Congress. He's used three different names to hide his family's ties to terrorism. His grandfather masterminded the Munich Olympic massacre. His father said they deserve to die.
So that's absurd. And you looked into how effective that advertising was for Duncan Hunter. What did you find?
Yeah, so as you can see from the ad, I mean, this is a overtly, strongly Islamophobic ad that, you know, really had no basis in truth. And so I wanted to see how effective is this? And then importantly, can these highly Islamophobic ads be countered? So what I found is, I ran an experiment. Basically, I had 1,000 respondents, a nationally representative sample, and I randomly assigned these respondents to three groups. The first group read a biography, a short biography of Duncan Hunter, give some background information. The second group read that same biography and then watched this ad that you just showed. And then the third group watched the ad, read the biography, and then read an excerpt of an article where a bipartisan group of policy experts strongly condemned the ad as racist and bigoted. So what I found is that the ad really had no effect on Republican support for Duncan Hunter. It was about 76-78% after just reading the biography, stayed exactly the same after they watched the ad. But it did lead to a backlash against Democrats against Duncan Hunter. And then really interestingly, what I saw is that when Republicans read that excerpt of the ad saying that, you know, condemning this this campaign advertisement, support dropped by 22 percentage points. So this is huge because this shows that not only was this highly Islamophobic ad not very effective in increasing support, it can actually be countered in a way that can sway an election.
So it's interesting. I know, you know, we can only go so far with your research. I know you're probably going to have follow-up research as well. So in this particular case, you had bipartisan condemnation of the ad. I know that there has been this sort of idea out there for a couple of years that Democrats should be careful about calling things racist because you could turn off white voters. To the extent that your current research can speak to that, do you think that this is evidence that that might not actually be true?
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, you know, this research can only go so far. You know, a real world environment is different than a social science experiment. But I do think it provides evidence that these kind of ads should be called out. That when something looks and smells like it's racist, we should call it racist. And further, I actually have some research showing that Democratic voters are strongly supportive of Democratic candidates who advocate for Muslims and other minority groups. And so I think that provides further evidence that we should be talking about this. We should talk about race, and and candidates and the media should be showing support for these communities.
Manish, you talk about how you had a national sampling in this. The Willie Horton ad, I think, is the grandfather of all modern day racist ads. That was a Mike Dukakis ad when he was running for president against then Vice President George H.W. Bush. And it showed a furlough program that he had as governor of Massachusetts. And it showed a black man leaving prison. And it was considered astonishingly racist at the time. Though those types of tactics continue to now 30 years later. What other ads, you know, this was regional. Kampa Najjar countered that he never met his grandfather. He died 16 years before he was born. He wasn't even close to his father. So what kind of pushback can you have in places where you're like Mississippi, like Texas? I know the Colin Allred Pete Sessions ad this year. I don't know if you saw that, but it showed a black hand over a white woman's mouth. These kind of racist ads in places where racism has a history. Has that changed at all, or is there a better effect there?
Well, you know, I do think things have changed since Willie Horton. I will also say that when Jesse Jackson did call out that ad as being racially charged, you did see support for George H.W. Bush drop. And so even then, calling out the ad as racist did seem to have an effect. Also, you know, there are national ads. You know, you saw the ad that the Trump campaign released just a week before the election, which was highly racist, even to the point that Fox News ended up pulling it off the air. And so I think when we see pushback to these, even in areas, for example, you know, Cindy Hyde-Smith with her public hanging comments in Mississippi, she did end up winning that race. But by about 8 percentage points in a state that Trump won by 18 points. And so when these comments, these ads are called out for their racist content, even in places like Mississippi, Alabama, these places where we've seen these comments be much more prevalent, it does look like there can still be a positive effect.
Just very quickly, though, so when you talked about the Willie Horton, it was called out as being racist, but it was also, they think, crediting a lot of people then moving away from Dukakis or galvanizing a base that had a tendency toward that as well. So there is an effectiveness, is there not?
Absolutely. And yes, this is a good point to make, that these ads, it does look like in some scenarios, in some places, for some candidates, can be effective. But equally important to note is that then calling that ad out as racist, which is not always done, as John alluded to, does look like it can also sway an election.
Well, Manish, I want to thank you so much for joining us. And if you do continue along with this line of experimentation, I would love to see how it goes in other circumstances with other sorts of ads as well. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, the Senate has strongly rebuked the president on the current situation with our assistance to Saudi Arabia and the war on Yemen. We'll be breaking how that might play out in the near future after this. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Only minutes remaining, so let's talk about something important. Let's close it out. We closed out yesterday's show with Ted Cruz's beard. By the way, what'd you think?
It was, it's ridiculous. He can't grow a beard well. He
no,
shouldn't
it's,
have one.
Some people can't.
Right.
It's just, it happens.
He
I don't grow
wants
a
to be like
one.
Us, but it's just not happening for
yeah,
Ted.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about something debatably more important than his beard, the war in Yemen. Yesterday on the show, Congressman Ro Khanna talked about how he on the House side and Bernie Sanders and other senators, Mike Lee and Chris Murphy as well, are pushing to end our assistance to Saudi Arabia in their terrible war on Yemen. And within 24 hours, actually, there's been some pretty significant movement, a new vote. So it's a procedural vote in the Senate to effectively re-question and fundamentally change our relationship with Saudi Arabia in that conflict. It was 63-37. So in the modern day, that is as bipartisan as anything will ever be. And what's interesting is it's co-sponsored by Bernie Sanders and Chris Murphy on the Democratic side or independent side, caucusing with the Democrats, and Mike Lee, who is that's a pretty conservative senator there.
Yeah.
But it would force the US to cease its support for the Saudi-led coalition in its fight against the Houthi rebels in Yemen. Within 30 days, the White House has said that they would veto it. And in advance of that vote, they had dispatched Pompeo and others to try to pressure people not to vote for it. And let's talk about what that assistance looks like. If you haven't been following this conflict, why are we involved in it? What are we doing? The US is currently helping the Saudi-led coalition by providing them with intelligence, selling them arms and ammunition, and until recently, arguably, fueling planes in the conflict that has already left tens of thousands dead, millions more suffering from starvation and disease, terrible cholera outbreaks. The starvation there is absolutely dreadful and likely to get worse. And now we have one step closer to actually rebuking the president on that.
Right, and you saw the vote was 63-37, which is, somewhat could be veto proof if they get there. But it doesn't seem like 63 Republicans at final passage are going to support it. But yesterday, they didn't even think this vote was going to go the way it did. John Thune beforehand said they're just the votes aren't there. Mm-hmm. And he's, he's part of the Republican leadership in the Senate, the senator from South Dakota. But it is encouraging, and I think Chris Murphy is getting short shrift here a little bit because of the headline of Mike Lee, a Republican, and Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. But Chris Murphy has been the most consistent drumbeat against what's happening in Yemen. Yeah. And he has fought really hard to get his to get this bill to the floor and to woo Republicans and to also make it not seem that it was a drastic bill, but an important bill. And it was given a lot of fuel after what happened to Khashoggi.
Exactly. I want to return to that in just one second, but I want to just update you on a couple of the things that some of the sponsors have said since then. Bernie Sanders tweeted out, "Let's keep the pressure on and make it crystal clear to the world that the United States of America is not going to continue to be part of this horrible Saudi-led coalition in Yemen, which is causing so much death and misery." And Chris Murphy said, "I've been at this for 3 years and I am blown away by this, by a big bipartisan margin. The Senate just voted for the first time to move forward with a debate on ending American involvement in the Yemen war." And then he thanked his other co-sponsors. So thankfully, there have been people, both in the Senate, we're crediting them because they've been successful so far, but there have been those on the House side that have been pushing for this for some time. And yesterday on the show, Congressman Khanna said that he believes with the new incoming Democratic majority, they will be able to pass this finally.
Yeah.
It's been lagging slightly in comparison to the Senate, of course. This seems very overdue. I believe that many aid organizations are saying that this is the worst humanitarian crisis in the world right now. And we are aiding it in a number of different ways. And if you listen to the president, we're doing it so that we can sell some more weapons. That is our motivation. I'm curious, you mentioned Khashoggi, the killing of him. We had that briefing about what the CIA and others think about it, and Gina Haspel was not there.
Right.
Do you think that that was a misstep on the part of the White House?
Of course it was. I mean, and what they're doing is you have now created a right wing in America that doesn't believe what a community of people has always believed, whether it be, that our intelligence has not been a partisan thing.
Yeah.
And this administration has made it partisan. And by not having Gina Haspel there yesterday, it was clearly a misstep, but it was clearly something that they were scared of. So they knew exactly what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I guess in a perfect world, we would have had this measure pass, we would vote on the Senate, it would pass in the House, purely because of the horrible toll on the Yemeni people.
Yeah.
But if this apparently targeted killing of a critic of the Saudi regime, if that is what gets us past the hump, awesome, we should have that. Because I think Donald Trump's recent quotes over Thanksgiving break about, you know, and maybe did it, maybe didn't, but we need to sell weapons, I personally feel is one of the most horrendous, embarrassing things I've ever seen a president say.
And it's ironic that they talk about the smoking gun of all sort of symbols of, what they're missing here is a smoking gun when this is all about guns and weaponry anyway.
Exactly.
But there are times when you don't need a smoking gun in international relations. I mean, we're not talking about a court of law and a jury of your peers here. This is a jury of the world, and it's pretty clear what happened.
And I want to say briefly, so we're talking about how Gina Haspel should have been there to brief him. Look, Gina Haspel, I didn't want her to be the head of the CIA. I think she's terrible. It's not my stance that anything the CIA necessarily has to be true. But some people have taken the CIA either not being fully forthcoming in the past as you should never believe anything the CIA ever says again, which is, of course, absurd.
Right.
But and especially
it's the position that needs to be there. It's not Gina Haspel. Whether you wanted Gina Haspel or Mickey Mouse, the person who heads this.
I wanted Mickey Mouse.
Probably you got her. The person who's the head of intelligence of the United States is the one that should be going before Congress. So whoever it is and whenever it is.
Yeah, and by the way, people often give the example of the lead up to the Iraqi war and say that the intelligence agencies all lied to us. Okay, they did some stuff, but it was largely the politicians manipulating and selectively using intelligence. It was not primarily an intelligence issue. It was a manipulation of intelligence issue, which we're effectively in yet again.
And we don't know if they're lying to us if they're not coming to talk to us.
Exactly.
We need to actually have that first.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. I will say again, if you haven't yet rated the podcast, please do that on iTunes. Thank you, Michael, for joining us. Always
Love
good
it.
To have you in.
Love being on TDR.
Thank you. And thank you for watching. We'll see you tomorrow morning. Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.